Welcome to the Infrastructure Show. I'm your host, Professor Joseph Schoffer of Northwestern University. The Infrastructure Show is designed to present to listeners the reality of America's infrastructure, its condition, why it is the way it is, and what can be done about it. We gratefully acknowledge contributions to sustain the Infrastructure Show from Dr. Robert Peskin, Dr. Raymond Ellis, and Andrea and Ron DeFeo. Vessel collisions with bridges are more common than people realize, and they present major risks to bridge users, to ship operators, and to the free flow of logistics. The American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials, along with the Federal Highway Administration, develop and update design guidance for bridges considering the risk of collision. But just how safe are major bridges today? With us today to discuss the risks and mitigation options for vessel collisions is Mike Winters, who's professional engineer and senior structural engineer with Moffitt & Nichol, a U.S.-based global infrastructure advisor. Mike is the principal U.S. representative to an international committee established by the Permanent International Association of Navigation Congresses to develop guidelines associated with ship collisions with bridges and other fixed structures. Mike, I'm really happy to be talking to you today, and I'm looking to learn a lot about bridge safety.
Thank you for having me on.
Just how common are these bridge collision events?
They're actually probably more common than the general public realizes. There was actually a study done by the U.S. Coast Guard. It was published in 2003. It was for a 10-year period, and it dealt primarily with barge collisions, the 10-year period from 1992 to 2001. And on average, there were about 5 accidents per week. So they happen on the order of, you know, about once a day almost. Now, about 98% of those were minor damage, only resulted in minor damage to the bridge. So it may have bumped into something, did minor to little, no damage, and then moved on about its way. About 2% of those do result in major accidents, though, and those are significant damage, collapse of a structure, fatalities, and oil spills. So large environmental concerns with that. So it does happen, probably more prevalent than the folks would realize. Some of the reasons why those things happen, it's the fact that most accidents occur because of human performance, their pilot error. Some of those occur because of mechanical and electrical failures, which is what they're finding happened at the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore, Maryland. Adverse weather conditions play into this, as well as other contributing bridge-type issues.
I want to interrupt you for a second, because one of the things that occurs to me is that I've looked at safety statistics, and it's not unusual to see that there are a lot of minor events that in a microsecond could have been a major event. So is it possible to look at these frequent minor events as indicators of larger risks?
It could be an indicator. What that does for us is it shows that there's actually an aberrancy issue on a waterway. An aberrancy is the ship's not where it's supposed to be.
Ah, okay. I'm sorry. Yes. So go along. You were talking about this database. So when you look at the risk database overall, particularly on ocean-connected waterways, is it an international database, or are you focusing on U.S., or is there a reason to do geographic segmentation?
We can do both. What happens now is when we're looking at vessel transits and traffic on a particular waterway, we use AIS data. It's an automated identification system. All vessels, all commercial vessels, be it in the U.S. waters or foreign waters, are required to have this. It's somewhat similar to a GPS-type system, and it tracks where the vessels are. So we can look at specific waterways and determine from there, what type of information needs to be ascertained.
And I've read somewhere that the data on the actual vulnerability of specific bridges are classified. That is, they're not publicly available. Is that true?
It's true for most cases. You have to remember that the vessel collision can also be utilized as a terrorist threat type situation where, it's not just a vessel running out of control, running into something and causing a collapse or a major impact. It can also be that, we've done threat assessments where you actually purposefully, someone's hijacked or taken control of a vessel and purposefully are trying to run in and do damage. So, yes, they are they are classified in some instances, because it is a vulnerability to the major infrastructure. There are certain cases, Canada, we've done projects in Canada, they have quite robust sunshine laws, so everything's kind of done over the board and publicly available. But in the U.S., most of them are considered vulnerability analyses, and as such, they have some sort of classification or, trying not to leak that information out to the general public.
So what's the level of awareness of these kinds of risks among professional bridge designers?
Among designers, it's definitely known because in the code, it is a requirement to design for vessel collision in the new code for all new structures. So it's very well, firms, designers, engineers that are designing new bridges in the U.S. Are certainly required to design for vessel collision and take vessel collision into account.
And these are the new, I'm going to give credit to ASHTO, the ASHTO standards?
That's correct. And just a little, if you want me to delve into just a first
sure, go ahead, please.
Background on the ASHTO standards and how they kind of came about. 1980 was the turning point where there being some kind of bridge code development. Prior to that, everything a vessel running into or taking out was considered an extreme event, almost an act of God, and so they weren't accounted for. Now, in the 1980, there were two major collapses that occurred. One of them was the Tjorn Bridge in Sweden. The Tjorn Bridge was actually it was a nice arch-type bridge. It actually had won numerous architectural awards for its beauty. Although with an arch-type bridge, the problem is that your vertical clearance in the middle of the channel and in the middle of the arch is at its maximum. But it doesn't take far wandering outside of the channel before the arch now starting to come down toward the ground, and it caused a collapse. And then also in 1980 in the U.S., in Tampa, Florida, there was the collapse of the Sunshine Skyway Bridge. And in that collapse, it was a relatively small ship that was traveling during a severe thunderstorm with reduced visibility. It actually missed the main span, took out a side span, the bridge collapsed in the water, and unfortunately there were 35 lives that were lost. Most of those that were lost, the majority of them were actually on a bus. Basically, the bridge just fell out from underneath them. The bus had no idea the bridge wasn't there anymore, and drove off of the end of the bridge, and perished. So that was kind of the starting point with the development of codes, and a lot of the work, the background work that was done on that, was done for the replacement structure for the Sunshine Skyway Bridge. A lot of background, and then in 1988. There was a pool-funded research project. It was funded by 11 states and FHWA, Federal Highway Administration, to develop a code. And there wasn't a code. There was no national, international codes associated with vessel collision. And so in 1991, ASHTO adopted the guide specification for vessel collision design of highway bridges. And that was the first document, and it was the gold standard, and it still is a gold standard. It's actually used throughout North and South America, Asia, and other parts of the world. Europe has their own codes, specifically Eurocode, but it was the first code and it acted as a lot of background. So 91 was the first version of the code. In 2009, the code was updated. Primarily, the updates were taking it to an LRFD-type methodology. There wasn't a lot of the background that was done. And then over the years, the guide specification has actually been superseded by the ASHTO LRFD bridge design specifications. One of the issues, as I've gone around and given presentations, one of the issues with that is the guide specification was actually about 240 pages long, included a lot of background information, a lot of commentary, actually had worked examples in it. But whenever that was certainly rolled into the code, the bridge design code, it's only about 20 pages now. So we've always told folks that if you're going to be doing this, working in this realm of ASHTO, the vessel collision design, that you really need to work from the guide specification. The code is certainly it's a more limited version of the guide specification. It has all the equations and everything in it that you would need, but it lacks some of the background information associated with it.
So it's interesting. What you're really saying is, if you're going to do this as a regular activity, you really have to understand the fundamentals.
That's correct. Absolutely. And
before you go on, I need to catch you on another term that maybe some of us are not familiar with, and that's LRFD design,
load resistance factor design.
Yeah,
it's just a philosophy of design that changed back in the early designs of steel and concrete. We utilized ASD, or allowable stress design philosophies, and then through the 70s, 80s, 90s, there was a transition to load resistance factor design. So it's just a different, slightly different methodology. It's they're very similar in the results that they come up with, but there's certainly different methodologies to get to that.
So are you confident that people that are in the design business have this kind of background to do the job safely?
I am. There's several firms out there that have done some of these newer bridge designs. I don't think anyone that's doing that is uninformed. I think that how this is front page news now, given the incident in March. Everyone that's doing these type of designs are well informed, have done them before, and it's not something new. Someone's not just picking up the code and doing it for the first time for a large major infrastructure project in the U.S.
Are designers working to control the probability of loss? Is there a particular quantitative target that they're focused on?
There is. So the way the AASHTO goes through and does, there's a couple methods. The guide specification actually consisted of three methods. The code itself, and by code I mean the AASHTO LRFD bridge design specifications, but the guide specifications originally had three methodologies. The code doesn't even mention one of the three, but they utilize what we call the method two. But in the guide specification, the method one was basically a simple, very simple, semi-deterministic type methodology for determining design vessels. The method two was a probability-based risk analysis. And then the method three was nothing more than a method two risk analysis with the addition of a benefit-cost ratio tied to it. But in the equation in the AASHTO guide specification, there's an annual frequency of bridge collapse that we determine. And that annual frequency of collapse is, there's two criteria. One of them is what's considered a regular bridge, and one of them is considered a critical bridge. For a regular bridge, risk of collapse is 1 in 1,000 years, a return period of 1 in 1,000 years. And for a critical bridge, it's 1 in 10,000 years. And I know a lot of folks probably ask, well, aren't all bridges critical? And a lot of that has to do with more the transportation link. If you took out a bridge and the detour was 100 miles to go around, then that's certainly more critical than if you could just drive a few blocks down the street and cross the river, i.e. like in Pittsburgh, where there's numerous crossings of a waterway. So that's where we establish kind of the critical nature of the bridge. But in the equation, the annual frequency collapse is calculated from a couple of, and it's really only just a handful of components. There's the N term, which is the annual number of vessel trips, and we typically classify those by type, size, and loading condition, which could strike a bridge element, be a pier or the superstructure. There's a PA term, and that's the probability of aberrancy. That's basically how often does the vessel go off course. We have a PG term, that's a geometric probability. And that states if the vessel goes off course, will it hit part of the bridge? We have a PC term, the probability of collapse. That is, if the bridge is hit, will it collapse? There's a PF term, and that's a protection factor. And that means, are there things in the way, upstream or downstream, maybe land masses or other structures, that would protect the bridge and keep a vessel from running into it? And then there's finally another term called growth factor, and that's usually where we look at the growth on the waterway. Is the waterway, the tonnage on the waterway, number of vessels on the waterway, is it generally increasing or decreasing? I mean, what we'll typically do is we're running the risk analysis to the mid lifespan of the bridge. So it may be, could be 50 years, 100 years out, depending on what the design life of the structure is.
So it sounds like a sequence of decision questions as you're putting the information together to understand what the risks are and how you respond to that risk, this series of factors that you just described.
It is. And what it allows us to do is, especially for a new bridge, once we have kind of the model, the risk model up and running, it allows us to do a lot of what-if type scenarios as we're designing. It allows us, what if we make the span slightly larger? Because then it actually pushes the piers a little farther away from the navigation channels. What if we make the pier slightly stronger? How does that relate to and affect the annual frequency of collapse calculations?
So you can do a trade-off analysis in the design process.
Absolutely, and that's what's done routinely with the new bridge, especially.
And presumably, all these options trade off against not only risk but the cost of building the structure.
And that's obviously the other cost or the other factor that's involved is certainly cost. We could certainly protect every structure existing new, but there's a cost associated with that. Sometimes for existing bridges, the cost of protecting the bridge may be as much as cost of rebuilding the bridge because protection systems for structures are not cheap. For a new structure, they may be somewhere on the order of 25% to 50% of the cost. For an existing structure, it could be 50% to 100% of the cost. So certainly cost, and with limited financial budgets with both federal highways and the state departments of transportation, it's something that has to be considered.
It's interesting, though, when I think about it, that a priori, I can look at this trade-off and make what seems like a rational decision. But then in the worst-case outcome where you lose a critical structure and you lose lives, in retrospect, does that take you back to rethink what that decision was and how you might have weighted that outcome differently and come up with a different design?
There are certain aspects of the design that we have to consider. And try not to hindsight a lot of decisions that are made. But once again, they cost and functionality, service life, things like that. They all factor into the design of the structure. Most of structures that aren't over a navigable waterway, they still have a lot of these components associated with them. It's just there is a probability risk associated with vessel collision whenever you're crossing a navigable waterway.
So how do you deal with a situation where you've got all the data that you've described and you have the tools and you're looking ahead, say, designing a bridge with an expected life of 50 years? How do you anticipate what the ship traffic and the nature of the ships might be 50 years downstream? Because what we know is that the size of ships, particularly container ships, has changed radically in the last 30 or 40 years.
You're absolutely right. And it is a little bit of a crystal ball. One of the things that we do consider is a waterway. What's the water depth on a waterway? Because there's draft limitations on a vessel. How deep below the waterline can the vessel be? Without some facilities, some harbors, it would cost billions and billions of dollars to deepen them. So we certainly look at that. The other thing is the Panama Canal. Most vessel traffic that comes from China is coming through the Panama Canal. And there are reasons for that. There's obviously financial reasons for doing that. And the Panama Canal has restrictions on the size of vessels that can come through. You are correct. The size of container ships over the last 30-plus years has grown relatively exponentially, but we're starting to probably see the limit of what they can do, what they can pass through the Panama Canal. So there is a restriction there. And then the harbors. Not only with the water depth, we have air draft restrictions on some harbors. If bridges are crossing, then they have to be able to pass underneath a bridge. So there is a limiting size where we're going to run out of how big vessels can be. Now, I will point out that when you start looking at some of the other sizes of vessels, like bulk carriers and tankers, things like that, vessels that are really large have been around for generations. There have been really, really large tanker ships that, you know, far outsize what an old container ship would have been. But they've been around for decades. So those are also vessels in a fleet that would be considered as part of the risk analysis.
So they're in your database, in effect.
Yes, absolutely. When we go through and we start a project, it's typically, like I said, we're utilizing that AIS database for a specific harbor. We're looking at what specific vessels are transiting, in what direction, how fast are they going, what loading condition, are they ballasted or light, or are they traveling loaded? This is all information that we can ascertain from the AIS data. And so from there, we're able to then develop a vessel fleet for the waterway. And with that vessel fleet is when we run our risk analysis.
So is there a feedback that goes to marine operations? That is, can you look at the risks and say, well, in this channel, let's limit operations in the following way to protect the physical infrastructure?
Absolutely. And that's something that can be done. Although remember that that those restrictions in the waterway, be it a speed restriction, because that would affect the impact force and impact energies. Obviously, you know, speed is a function of those. You know, whether or not tugs would be required on certain vessels. But remember that the DOT or the owner of the bridge cannot implement those restrictions. Those would have to be implemented by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and or the U.S. Coast Guard. So there's a combination of working together. And let's say, for instance, you have an existing harbor with existing vessel traffic and you're putting in a new bridge and you're wanting to implement some restrictions on them. Well, there's usually cost associated with those restrictions. Let's say you're requiring a tug or an additional tug to pass through a waterway. Well, who pays that? Who pays that cost if it's implemented? The marine terminal operator or the shipping company themselves. And so there is this hesitancy to do a lot of restrictions type of on waterways to try to make things better for the bridge. And there are important things to know about bridges. Some people may not be aware of it, but bridges are actually obstructions to marine navigation in the U.S. You know, there's a hierarchy of how goods were moved in the U.S. over the years, over the hundreds of years we've been around. You know, it's basically the shipping industry is king. Then came the railroad industry, and then the highways came after the fact. And so that's kind of the order hierarchy is. But bridges are built as obstructions to navigations, and the mariners have the right of way, not motorists. Bridges must provide for the reasonable need of the navigations. Bridges are permitted to be built as obstructions to navigation by the Coast Guard, and they have to be maintained in accordance with those permits. Whenever there's an incident on the U.S. waterways, those are handled by what's called admiralty law, and they're handled in admiralty courts, and they have legal jurisdiction over vessel collision accidents. And there are times when, a vessel can run into a bridge and a bridge collapses, and maybe some navigation lights or something weren't maintained in accordance with U.S. Coast Guard permits, and the bridge owner can actually be held liable because your bridge fell down on my ship, and it has been done, and it has been won in that case. So a lot of people, I think, don't understand that the shipping industry is actually, they have the right of way. And the bridge is an obstruction to that right.
Interesting that there is that priority that's existed for centuries, really.
Yes.
So do you see situations where sometime in the life of a bridge, circumstances have changed, codes have changed, and there's a reason or motivation to go back and make a modification to the bridge or introduce some kind of protection for that bridge?
Yes, absolutely. We do an initial, for instance, for a new bridge, we do a risk analysis that's incorporated into the design. But like you mentioned previously, you know, we're somewhat crystal balling what the vessel traffic's going to be, what the size ships are going to be. And so going back and during the lifespan of the structure, doing an updated risk analysis, seeing where we are, and then the possibility of adding either additional protection or maybe new protection. Maybe there was no protection at all. Maybe the bridge was designed sturdy enough where it could handle the vessel collision and didn't need a secondary type structure to handle that. So I could see that as definitely being the case. And that's kind of what's done for existing bridges as well. There's a lot of infrastructure in the U.S. that predated the code. These structures were certainly built robustly, but there was no code, back in the 80s and prior to that dealt with vessel collision. So doing a risk analysis to kind of see where you are. Now, there's no criteria that the bridge owner has to meet for these existing structures that were predated. But what it does is it allows them to know what risk there is and then what type of protection systems could be done. And then they can start doing some benefit cost of, well, do we protect the bridge? Do we look at replacing the bridge? Things of that nature.
So it's really not a matter of, well, the code change came after we built the bridge, so we're grandfathered and we're good.
That's kind of the way a lot of them are, but a lot of bridge owners now are understanding the risk associated. Once again, that's highlighted by the collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge. A lot of bridge owners are wanting to know, they're wanting to look into and say, well, what risk do we have? And if we do have risk, what type and how much would it cost to implement a protection type structure?
I would think that's something that gets included in your responsibility as a licensed professional engineer.
Yeah, absolutely. We reach out to DOTs. DOTs reach out to us, bridge owners. Not all bridge owners are, not all bridge structures are owned by DOTs, Departments of Transportation. Some are owned by, some toll authorities own structures. And so they do. They reach out to see what type of, can we perform a risk analysis on these existing structures? And the answer is yes, and we do. And we work closely with them to try to help them understand what type of risk there are, what type of criteria to maybe design toward, things of that nature.
Are there some innovations in design that provide some extra protection to an existing bridge or even a new bridge?
Those are probably are tried and true. They've been around a long time. One of the things as engineers that we have trouble kind of understanding in our minds is most of these protection structures are designed as, especially for large ships, for barges, smaller vessels, you see sometimes on the inland riverway systems, they're certainly, designed. They get hit all the time, like we mentioned, they're rubbed against, they're things of that nature quite frequently. But for the large ships and the protection systems associated with it, they're designed as a sacrificial element. And so when they're hit, they're meant to be destroyed, because what happens in the vessel collision, there's obviously an impact force, there's also an impact energy, and the vessel's not stopped until we've dissipated all of that energy. And so in order to dissipate these large energies, and the forces are large. For a container ship, a decent sized container ship traveling at about 8 knots, you may be looking at about 50,000 kips of impact force and over 1 million kip feet of impact energy. And so for a structure to resist that in an elastic range is not feasible. So with the design speed, the design vessel, what we do is we run these things into these protection structures. They typically will consist of either a cellular coffer cell, which that's basically just steel sheet piles driven in a circular pattern, filled with stone or sand type material, capped with a big concrete cap to hold them together. Or they build these just pile supported foundation rings. Similar, they're just a sacrificial structure, typically offset to a certain manner to where if and when they are hit and collapsed, the ship cannot run into or impact the bridge. Others, types of structure or systems that have been used in the U.S. are islands. The problem with island structures is that they're creating just land around the pier so that the vessel runs aground. But the problem with those is that they're incredibly difficult for environmental reasons to get permitted. But they are probably one of the safer types of protection system, because if a ship runs into a hard structure, we're dissipating the energy. The energy is dissipated by the collapsing of the structure, but it's also the crushing of the vessel. There's going to be crushing of the vessel that happens. And so with that crushing, there may be some adverse impacts, oil spills, things of that nature. The islands are usually a little bit more forgiving on the ship. The ship will just run through the island. But those are the primary types of protection structures. But those types of protections and those types of structures have been around for a long time. So I don't know that there's anything new and innovative associated.
But there are things that work.
There are things that work. They're tried and true. We know what they work. And it consists of, it's a robust structure surrounding it. It's just it's a collapsible structure. I liken it to like a guardrail. When you're traveling down the interstate doing 70 miles an hour and you get over and you run into the guardrail's, its job isn't to bounce you back or whatever. It's basically to arrest the energy. It's going to fail. It's going to.
Well, it's like the crushable front of a car.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
This has been tremendously interesting, and you've taken us down some important paths that have taught me some lessons about data and risk and the challenge of making the decisions to manage, to design these bridges and to manage these bridges in a changing environment. Mike, thank you very much for spending the time educating us about bridge risks and bridge risk management. It's been an education. There's a lot more that we have to learn, but you've taken us down a path that's very important for the safety of the nation and our waterways. So good to be with you this morning.
Thank you, Professor Schaefer, for your time.
Okay. Be well. Take care.
Thanks, sir.
Thanks for listening to The Infrastructure Show. If you enjoyed the conversation as much as we did, please subscribe to our podcast and encourage your friends to join us too. The Infrastructure Show is recorded at the Studio Media Recording Company in Evanston, Illinois, under the direction of Scott Steinman, recording engineer with a commitment to great sound. Our producer is Marion Sowers, a journalist with a passion for infrastructure. And I am Professor Joseph Schoeffer. Few people are more curious about infrastructure than I am.